Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this weekend edition, a look at a couple of headlines that grabbed our attention. Also, what's coming up this weekend on KPCG and what's on thetrumpet.com as well. Also, we're going to take a look at an important historical note that I think is quite interesting. And continue to go through the great book, Russia and China in Prophecy, talking a lot about Japan today. And what they're up to. That and more on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm, and any emails you'd like to send, go ahead and send those into comments at kpcg.fm. We'd like to look at those. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today, and it's colder. It got a little colder here the last few days in particular, so definitely autumn's in the air, Grant, and whenever autumn comes around, it makes me think of delicious warm beverages. You feel
yes,
the same?
Definitely.
Yeah. This is a new one that you might want to try, limited edition, if you can go to a Tim Hortons. I don't think we have any around here, but Canada, other places, very popular. This is a drink. A limited edition Buffalo Latte is Canadian fast food chain Tim Hortons' latest addition to select U.S. locations. So, okay, if you can find a select U.S. location, do this maybe. The spicy espresso drink is served with a whipped topping dusted with buffalo seasoning, a tangy flavor usually reserved for wings. So I don't know. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they're going to give it a try. It's a unique flavor combination. I'd be willing to give it a shot if I could find one.
Yeah, buffalo seasoning, I guess that would give it more of a spicy tinge as well. So that often translates to heat. So if your objective is to be warm, I think that might be a sort of an indirect way of doing that.
They should sell those at the Buffalo Bills football games.
I know. That's what I was thinking right away.
That would
good
be
marketing.
That's why Buffalo Wings got their name, right? It came from Buffalo, New York.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because I think one of my kids was asking me that the other day, and I didn't know. I think my wife looked it up.
Yeah, it's kind of strange because buffalo is also the name of an animal. And so you're talking about the name of an animal, but then also chicken wings. So there's a lot of confusion there.
It's very confusing, yeah. Anyway, it might be a fun drink to try out. It seems like this time of year, a lot of those coffee places have their special drinks they trot out. I'm going to take a guess that it's probably not healthy for you, but maybe get a small one. Try it once. See how it goes. A lot to talk about today, including a couple of headlines. This one's from the BBC. Catalan Parliament declares independence from Spain. You've probably been paying attention to this a little bit anyway on the news. The Catalan Regional Parliament has voted to declare independence from Spain just as the Spanish government appears set to impose direct rule. So there's some controversy there about whether they would be independent or whether Spain would come in there and really take over. They've been part of Spain in a way, I guess, for a while, but sort of their own little territory, too. The move was backed 70-10 in a ballot boycotted by opposition MPs. Spanish Prime Minister earlier told senators direct rule was needed to return law, democracy, and stability to Catalonia. The crisis began when Catalans, as they're called, I guess, backed independence in a disputed vote earlier this month. And so anyway, they're thinking about what they're going to do there. So I don't know what will happen. That'll be interesting to see, but they want independence there in Catalonia, and Spain wants to reestablish law and order as they see it. So there's definitely a conflict brewing.
I think that independence referendum might have even been disallowed by Spain, and yet they just did it anyway. And I think they had one with the Kurds voting to leave Iraq as well. And you just wonder how that actually works. If the nation doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the vote, it seems like the only next step is war.
Yeah, it's definitely a dispute. They say that Spain's Senate is still to vote on whether, for the first time, to enact Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution, which empowers the government to take, quote, all measures necessary to compel a region in case of a crisis. That language is a little bit vague, but that could mean just about anything. All measures necessary to compel. We would like to compel you to, you know, keep following our rule by declaring war on you.
It seems like we've had some experiences with that here in America, too, with the Civil War, making sure that we didn't turn into two separate nations, kind of doing something similar with Texas, too. So we can relate to that a little bit. If you're a national government, you can't just have people or huge chunks of your nation deciding one day that they want to leave.
They say it would enable Madrid to fire Catalan leaders and take control of the region's finances, police, and public media. So from what I could tell about it, that Catalonia region is, they do better economically. There's more money there, and so they do pay in quite a bit in taxes, and they don't get as much back as they think they should. So they have a little bit of a beef there, and Spain's had some economic problems like some of those European nations has. So it's an interesting history if you look into it. So we'll see where it goes. I would imagine it wouldn't come to a full-fledged war, but who knows? It seems like they'll probably talk their way around it or come up with some sort of compromise. But it is interesting how, you know, one group says, well, we have power and we're going to fire the leaders of the other group. And they say, well, we don't recognize your power. I'm not fired. You're fired. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just sort of an interesting thing. It's like firing an employee who won't leave. You know, how do you really fire him without, you know, very physically removing them from the premises?
Well, that's the hard part. I mean, if war seems unlikely, then the only thing that you do after that is maybe act like the vote didn't even happen, because otherwise, there's no way to enforce what you just voted to say that you wanted to do. It just gets a little bit complicated there. But even historically, overtaxation has led to a lot of conflict. I mean, America's gripe with Britain was that they were being taxed without having representation in Parliament. And so you can understand why people who feel like they're paying more than they should would want to vote for independence or at least speak up against that.
Be interesting to keep an eye on it. So thetrumpetcourse.com, we'll be keeping an eye on that. So check that for some analysis. Here's a story we've been following for a while here in the United States about the NFL protests. This is some good common sense, I think. Steelers icon Vietnam vet Rocky Blair on NFL protests. He said it should never have gotten to this point. They say few people involved in the NFL's ongoing national anthem debate are as qualified to discuss the subject as former Pittsburgh Steelers halfback Rocky Blair. He's 71 years old, served in the U.S. military during the Vietnam War, and he lost part of his right foot due to a combat injury and had to fight his way back into the NFL. So he's been on both sides with the military and in the professional football. They say for him, he's, of course, a four-time Super Bowl champion with the Steelers. The situation is very much cut and dry, and he sees a simple solution to the issue. He says, look, it's very simple. This is a workplace. You are at the stadium. You are working that day. This is not a platform for protest. The American people, they can't go to their workplace and start to protest about whatever may be happening in their life. That wouldn't be allowed, and that shouldn't be allowed in the NFL. It's a violation. He says it's not a violation of the First Amendment at all. You have off days. You can do it outside of the stadium or on other platforms, but not on the game day platform. It's a very simple question, and people are making it more complex than it really is. He says you can't allow it to continue to drag on. Otherwise, it will be like an open sore that heals, and if you peel off the scab again, it will continuously be there. So a lot of people have said that, and he says the same thing, and I think it's pretty logical. I mean, you're being paid, and but of course, as he pointed out as well, the owners have to step up and make a rule.
Exactly. And the contention of people watching these games who can't stand watching the protests at the same time, that's exactly what he's bringing out there, is that no one else in the entire country is allowed to do the same thing at their place of employment. You can think whatever you want to about the injustice of the country, but why are you shoving it in the face of people who are paying to watch your athletic prowess? These are people who are fans of you. and they want to see you do something that you are outstanding at, and they're paying their hard-earned money to see that. They're not paying to see a protest. Protests, in fact, are never pleasant. Even people on the left are saying that. That's why how they're trying to justify it. Protests are never pleasant. So that alone should explain why it shouldn't be in NFL stadiums, because you're pushing something that isn't pleasant on people who are there and paying their money to see something. People don't pay to see things that are unpleasant. So clearly, it just totally contradicts their idea as a business, which is to, you know, keep their mouths shut, do their job, and that's it. You can say as much as you want to outside of the workplace. No one is telling them to not ever speak, ever.
Yeah, that's a really good point that, you know, that's why you go to a sporting contest, is to enjoy it and to have a good time, because you enjoy right. it. No one's going to pay for something that they don't enjoy, I think. So, unless it was an emergency procedure or something. but yeah, so they're going to need to figure out what they want to do there. I don't know if it's related maybe to all this politics or whatever. Maybe it's changing technology too, but there's a story today that ESPN is going to face another big round of layoffs because they're just not making the money they used to, I guess, and they pay a lot for these sports, and the ratings kind of are going down in some ways. So it's interesting, but a lot of people do kind of point the finger at sort of the blending of the two together, the sports and the politics, and those are two very different things that really shouldn't be combined, probably, especially because, like you said, people go to sports for entertainment and enjoyment, and politics is... Well, it can be entertaining, I guess, but it's not very enjoyable, I don't think.
Yeah, that's exactly the point, is that these are two things that just don't mix. There are all kinds of things in life that simply don't mix, and what you do is you don't mix them. You don't just decide that, well, these are two things that we enjoy separately, so we're going to smash them together in some sort of a nasty combination and somehow enjoy that, too. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and... A lot of these players seem to just have a total disregard for what their fans want to see. I mean, they have millions of social media followers. They have a huge platform to get out whatever their message is. The only thing people are asking is, why do you have to force it on us at your job too?
Yeah, it hasn't worked even for, say, individuals. There's been a few people that make their money in the political talk, and they've tried to do sports. Rush Limbaugh, you remember he tried to do Monday Night Football?
Oh, yeah.
For a while, and nobody really liked that. And then Keith Olbermann, he's kind of danced back and forth between sports and politics. And it just doesn't sit well, I don't think. It just doesn't work.
Well, half the people who are watching you for politics are not going to like you. And so whenever you then transition into sports, the same groups of people who liked you in politics are probably going to like you in sports, but the same... people who disliked you in politics are also going to dislike you in sports. Normally, if you leave the politics out of it, that's the most divisive issue in the entire country. Then people are fine with sports in general. You don't have half the people hating the announcer, usually, unless they're just maybe not that good at their jobs.
Yeah. Well, and too, even if just within the sports realm, that the announcers or the hosts that typically people don't like as much are the ones that are very biased in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they prefer people that are just sort of honest and looking at the games and analyzing the players and things. And so, you know, if you bring on somebody that's political, of course they're biased.
Right.
So it's a topic you probably don't want to hear about, and you got to hear their bias and all that. So it just doesn't work very well. So anyway, CNN, or ESPN, rather, got some more layoffs coming. That, you know, can you imagine going into the a board meeting there at ESPN and saying, I got a great idea for you. What if... we like sort of combined ESPN and C-SPAN. You get laughed out of the room, like that's insanity. But that's what they're doing, sort of. And it doesn't work, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, C-SPAN obviously has a stereotype of being extremely boring, because it just shows every single political activity in the nation's capital. But at least that would be maybe a little bit less contentious, because it's not presented with a certain political spin. It is what it is. It would just make for some pretty boring television,
right,
at that point, to put ESPN and C-SPAN together. So obviously not the best idea. The hard part about quoting a military veteran, which is the case here, and he's spot on, is that there are some other ones who have said opposite things. There is a small minority of military veterans who have absolutely no problem with the protest. So obviously you're not going to get an entire block of people who agree with who believe the exact same thing in this issue, even if they have been in the military. Some of them don't think that this is disrespectful to the military, even though it is. The problem is it just seems like truth has fled our society. We can't agree on anything in any situation because no one wants to believe or agree on what truth is anymore. It's whatever you feel. It's whatever you already agreed with. And then even when facts come into play, you don't have to agree with those or take any mind to those because they don't agree with what you already believed.
And just from a business standpoint, it's never smart to cater to the really small group, like the niche audience.
Yeah.
Because if you want to be a global empire like the NFL wants to be, you have to cater to the largest group. And that's just business. I mean, you could find a niche audience for probably anything, but is it enough? And it's funny too because they keep pushing the NFL product over in London, and I think they're doing it like every week, it seems like. And not only do you have all the anthem protest stuff and the concussion stuff, then they always send over teams that aren't good. I saw like whatever the upcoming game is. I thought, well, no one would want to watch that even in the U.S. You're going to send it to London? It was like the Browns. They haven't won in 30 years. No, they've won, but not much. So I just thought, well, that's not a good strategy if you're trying to like show the best of your product to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it is almost like the NFL is drawing scorn from all sides because it's like they're committing every business sin imaginable to drive fans away. I mean, all the commissioner of the NFL had to do at the very start was say, look, regardless of what your personal, political, and social beliefs are, we're not going to bring them into the workplace realm. You will be fined every game you do it, probably at least $1 million. Let's see how many of them want to get fined $1 million every game, $16 million a season. Only quarterbacks make that kind of money. So no one is going to do that. No one is going to be basically paying out of pocket to then go and play football games. They want to be making money from that.
It made me think of an interesting question. You were commenting how, of course, no one wants to pay for something, you know, that's not enjoyable. I wonder if anyone's ever paid to go watch a protest. Historically, like, has there ever been a time where people paid to watch somebody protest? I can't imagine it ever happening. I think you have to pay a fee sometimes if you want to protest. Like, you have to get the city to agree to it, but. Yeah.
Protests ruin days. That's kind of the point, is to get in people's face and force them to think about a topic that normally is unpleasant, that people don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about. And of course, it can also be a physical inconvenience, especially when some of these protests now are blocking roads, or they're throwing rocks through car windows, or they're vandalizing buildings. Those really shouldn't even be called protests anymore. Those should be called riots. But of course, they're not pleasant. And a lot of people have even been getting hurt lately in some of these different things. So protests are not meant to, drive sales. You know, they're not going to up ticket sales in the NFL because protests are associated with something that basically is going to ruin your day if you come across one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's interesting to see how that all continues to spiral. But I thought some good common sense advice there from Steelers icon, Vietnam vet Rocky Blear on the topic. Trumpet.com today, the top story ties into what we've been talking about. We're going through the book Russia and China and Prophecy. This is by Jeremiah Jacques, and the article title is Xi Jinping, a strong man now poised to rule China for decades. He really has taken quite a strong hold there in that country. The decision to enshrine Xi thought, as they call it, that's a cool expression,
yeah.
into the communist constitution elevates the president to the status of the hallowed Chairman Mao. So, yeah, I heard about that earlier this week. That's a really big deal over there. And so you can see China's really rallying around Xi thought.
Wow.
As it were. So make sure you check out that article, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Russia and China and prophecy later in the program, and of course that's a featured book there related to that article as well. Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury talks quite a bit about what's going on with Iran in the Middle East, And they're up to no good. Would you be surprised to find that out?
Not at all. That's just sort of their modus operandi. That's their entire goal, is to stir up trouble. And like a lot of topics we talk about, we have so many groups today all over the world that just want to stir up trouble. Iran is probably the most dangerous out of all of them.
He also mentions a little bit about an article by Brent Nachtigall that you can find at thetrumpet.com. Heretz's hit job on the Bible. It says, a lost opportunity to discuss the dramatic discoveries in ancient Jerusalem. And he's right over there in Jerusalem, too. So he's done a lot with the archaeology digs. So make sure you do stop and check out that.
Yeah, that is a really good article, too, because it just shows how even people who are talking about archaeological discoveries that may corroborate the Bible, they present Dr. Elot Mazar's discoveries of, you know, Solomon's Wall and King David's Palace as maybe minor exceptions to the general rule that archaeology doesn't support the biblical record at all. When isn't that some of the most important evidence you could possibly find of Israel being a magnificent, powerful kingdom and not just a little tribal village or something like that? I mean, it's almost the biggest evidence possible, and yet people are so skeptical. They don't want the Bible to even be proven true as a historical record, because if you do that, then you can go even further and say that the Bible is the infallible word of God and you must obey what it says.
Yeah, it's a really it gives a good insight just into the way the media works in general. If they want to highlight something, they can really make it seem like it's a big deal. But if they want to minimize it, they can still report on it, but they'll just oh, you know, no big deal here. And it really does color the way people see things, and that's definitely the case with, say, the archaeology.
Right, and the terrible part about that Heretz piece was that he just went to skeptics of the Bible who happened to be involved in archaeology, and he asked their opinion, and they denounced what Dr. Elot Mazar has found, even though their entire careers are based on, and they make money off of, being skeptical of the Bible. Of course they're not going to agree with those archaeological finds that prove them wrong. So there's no in-depth analysis whatsoever of the artifacts and the discoveries themselves to see if they stand up to the biblical record. It's just quoting people who, of course, are going to deny that it's factual.
Yeah, people really are very passionate when it comes to the Bible one way or the other.
Yeah.
And in this case, very anti-Bible, apparently.
Yeah, it really is true. And it definitely, that is an article worth reading, because it does show how stubborn we can be sometimes, of whatever our positions may be. And whenever you're as stubborn as that about the most important topic possible, which is whether or not the Bible is accurate and has any authority in our lives today, well, that's a difficult mindset to have and to overcome, because, of course, you can't get too far in life if you don't believe that the Bible is relevant today.
Yeah, it's interesting how, of course, many people would deny the Bible, or parts of it at least, and say, well, it's not an authoritative source, and yet when it comes even to physical things like a wall, or, you know, a building that the Bible talks about, and then there it is, people still will deny it. Yeah. It does, like you say, it just highlights how if people just don't want to believe something, it doesn't matter what evidence you show them, they're just not going to believe it.
Yeah, that's true. And Brent Nachtigall had me laughing in that article quite a lot when he was basically denouncing what the critics were saying, because there's one, for example, who was digging in the wrong spot and said he hadn't found anything major to show that Israel was a huge kingdom back then. And he's like, well, of course you didn't find anything, because the Bible said to dig here and you decided to dig somewhere else. Whose fault is that? And it's just so obvious sometimes that, you know, we can be stubborn and we just want to do it our own way, when here's a book. It has never been proven false, no matter what people say about it. And They're not looking into what it actually says and following it. They're just deliberately doing the exact opposite, and then they're befuddled when they don't find anything valuable.
Yeah, and I think the main reason for that resistance to even the archaeology is that if it proves correct, which it does, then you do have to start thinking about the rest of the Bible too. Mm. Does that prove correct? Are we under an obligation to follow it? And then that's really where the rubber meets the road, as they say. because that's where the resistance is.
Yeah, and he even brings out in the article that Dr. Mazar uses the Bible primarily as a historical document. She doesn't necessarily go too much further than that, but look at how blessed she has been in her work and her discoveries, simply for believing that when the Bible says to go down to the fortress, she actually goes down physically with the geography and finds exactly what she's looking for. And anytime the Bible lays out the geography, she searches the geography to find a spot that fits the description, digs there, and sure enough finds all this incredible proof that the Bible is true.
And if you're interested in what she's found, there's a lot about that at thetrumpet.com. This article is Harris's hit job on the Bible, and that's by Brent Nachtigall. You can read that today at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us on this weekend edition. An interesting historical note on this day, October 27th, 28th, somewhere in there, I guess I've seen a few different dates on it. In 1962, the U.S.-Cuba missile crisis ends. And after much posturing by both sides and the world living in fear of a nuclear holocaust, the United States and Soviet Union agree to a plan to end the two-week-old Cuban missile crisis. Big deal back then, of course, and still very relevant because Cuba is so relevant today for that reason in particular. Here's some audio. This is from the U.S. National Archives. It's called To the Brink, JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just a few minutes, kind of interesting historical information and about that Cuban Missile Crisis.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
It's an exhibit in which we really tell the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was certainly the most dangerous episode in human history. And we tell it by putting you inside the room where the president and his advisors were actually dealing with the crisis.
This is a result of photography taken somewhere, sir.
How do you know this is a medium-range ballistic missile?
The answer.
In the spring of 1962, Khrushchev decided to deploy a nuclear strike force in Cuba, 90 miles away from the United States. On the 14th of October, planes with cameras flying over Cuba found evidence of the missile site construction. President Kennedy was shown that evidence. He immediately called his advisors together. For the next 13 days, they tried to find a way to get those missiles out. The exhibit includes original documents, artifacts, photographs, but also tapes that were secretly recorded by President Kennedy in the cabinet room while he was meeting with his advisors.
This blockade and political action I see leading into war. It'll lead right into war. This is almost as bad as the appeasement of Munich.
They're extraordinary historical records of what happened.
So we're doing a pretty bad fix.
There's really nothing to reveal why the president created those tapes. Some historians say it's because he wanted them as he prepared his memoirs, but there's really, we just don't know. We introduce the characters of Khrushchev, leader of the Soviet Union, and Fidel Castro in Cuba by way of personality studies that were conducted by the CIA. We have the chairs that President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Khrushchev sat in, the one and only time they met officially, which was in Vienna in 1961. There's a document in the exhibit in which the president is announcing an airstrike on the missile sites in Cuba. It was never delivered, but it was prepared at a time when the president was trying to decide which course of action to pursue. We have a map that was used during the briefings, and we have in Kennedy's own hands where he marked where the missile site installations were. And it just gives you an extra dose of reality about the humanity of these people.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace.
Ultimately, it was resolved when Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles. The United States pledged not to invade Cuba, and secretly they promised that missiles that they had in Turkey would also be removed. The last piece of the exhibit is the original signed nuclear test ban treaty. Both nations started working toward agreement on limiting nuclear weapons. The two powers did sign the limited nuclear test ban treaty in 1963. No achievement ever gave the president more satisfaction.
So that was some audio there from the U.S. National Archives. The name of that piece was To the Brink, JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis. So on this day or these group of days, I guess I've seen a few dates on it, but Cuban Missile Crisis comes to an end in 1962. Big, big deal. And you can read a lot more about that and the significance of it and Cuba today in Great Again. The fourth chapter is The Deadly Deal with Cuba. And you can read that at thetrumpet.com. Really important. We were talking in when that audio was going there about how they just released a lot of those JFK documents. So lots of documents released there. I kind of read a little highlight article about them. I don't know that they highlighted the right things, but it seemed like it was the stuff they released was sort of trivial. Like they didn't get to the big questions I think everybody wants to know about. But there's some good indication of what happened, and you can read about that in Great Again there, that chapter 4.
Right, and the fact that a lot of the important information is still either sealed or unknown, it just kind of backs up the suspicion that Cuba may have been behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and obviously Cuba was heavily involved with the Soviet Union, so it would have been a communist plot, and like you were joking about, it wouldn't be Fidel Castro himself going and killing the president of the United States. They, of course, would hire someone and make it as many chains away from them as possible so that it would be hard to link back to Cuba and the communist regimes.
Yeah, the little write-up I saw, they said, well, you know, Cuba probably wouldn't have done it because it would you know, we would then wipe out Cuba. It wouldn't be worth it to them. And I was just kind of laughing to myself like, well, they're not going to make it that obvious. I mean, there's a little intrigue involved, you know, but anyway, so it's interesting they've released some of those documents. There might be more to it than meets the eye, you know, you'd have to read through all of them, but the little highlights I saw were not as exciting as maybe some people were hoping. I just always wonder, like, who is in charge of, like, crossing out documents? Who gets that authority? And then they know, right? So they just don't tell anybody. They must be really good at keeping secrets. Who is the guy that crosses out all the documents?
It's an impressive skill to be able to keep your mouth shut. I think we see that all the time. But just to be able to keep a secret like that, you have to admire whoever does the job. Supposing they actually keep the secret like they're supposed to.
Yeah, you would think that, well, I don't know. There's probably a lot of those secrets floating around out there that people would just know if they said something that would be bad news for them. Mm. So who knows, but it's interesting. We're talking this week about Russia and China and prophecy, and we're going to talk about Japan today a little bit. But before we get into them, I thought this was an interesting headline from today in relation to that region over there. This is from Newsweek. Vladimir Putin launches 4 ballistic missiles in nuclear forces drill across Russia. Does that make anyone a little nervous? It makes me a little nervous. Russian President Vladimir Putin personally took part in a late-night military drill of his nuclear-capable forces that launched 4 missiles across Russia, activating air and naval forces, the Kremlin announced. The drill launched 2 ballistic missiles from east to west, landing in Russia's northwestern region, and another 2 missiles were launched from the west of the country, landing in the eastern, which is separated from Alaskan territory by the Bering Sea. So people always made fun of Sarah Palin when she said that Russia was really close to Alaska up there. But it is. It is pretty close. They say tensions between Moscow and its western neighbors have been at a post-war high since Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. And its neighbor in the Far East, North Korea, is itself currently engaged in a tense nuclear posturing showdown with the U.S. Missiles flew near border regions between both eastwards and westwards. So they're definitely not non-active. They're shooting their missiles.
And I can't help but notice how little regard he has for his own land. The fact that he's launching missiles that are landing in his own country. I thought they normally shot those out into the ocean, at least, so they weren't hurting themselves, but maybe he just doesn't care that much.
It must be pretty barren regions. Nobody out there, or they're barren now. But so yeah, they've been launching those. I guess they use some subs too. So they're doing quite a bit there, and they're also they've got that new new one that I think it's called the Samat or Samat. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but that one's supposed to get going here pretty soon too. And I think that's the one that could wipe out Texas. Like this, that they could it could carry.
Is that the one translated as like a Satan missile?
The Satan, I think it is. If I'm correct in that, but anyway, it's one that they're trying to test here. So those regions are really starting to do a few things, you know, when they're launching missiles like that, it's like North Korea kind of started it. Now everybody's jumping on the bandwagon, see how many missiles they can launch.
And you know, there's always something more to a missile launch. It's not just to test that they are capable of doing what they think they can do. It's also to send a message to their rivals, even to their allies, to say, look, we have some power and you might want to stick with us instead of turning your back on us. There's a lot of posturing to be involved in something like this. Otherwise, you would think they could keep things like this a little bit more of a secret, maybe do it without the entire world knowing about it right away. It doesn't seem like that's their intention, though. It's like they want people to understand that they're doing a missile test, and they want people to be afraid.
Definitely. Yeah, they're sending a message. I wonder if there's a message in doing it late at night, too. Like, you know, oh, by the way, last night we launched a bunch of missiles. You know, just kind of throw you off a little bit. I don't know. Don't know why they did it that way, but... interesting anyway. So that was from Newsweek. Vladimir Putin launches 4 ballistic missiles in nuclear forces drill across Russia. We've been talking about Russia and China prophecy this week. It's a really important book, a lot happening in that region. You can get the book free at thetrumpet.com, and it's new and updated. And we're going to talk about the 5th chapter today, which is Japan's place in the future. Japan's part of that mix as well. It says, for the past 70 years, a strong relationship between the U.S. and Japan has guaranteed economic and military security in East Asia. But now, just like India and some of these other nations, it seems Japan's leaders are increasingly edging away from that partnership. Japanese militarism also has a dangerous history, and its most recent resurgence was only halted by the nuclear bombing of 1945. So since that time, of course, they've really relied on the U.S. in a lot of ways, and we've had a pretty good relationship there. But those relationships are changing, like we talked about with India yesterday. And again, they're looking, okay, where do we go here? Who are we going to partner with? And the natural partner there is back to the East.
Yeah, and this booklet and this chapter even bring out just how memories of World War II have faded. And the reason why we wanted to be so close to Japan is kind of based on that old saying, like, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Japan is the reason America even entered into World War II when they bombed Pearl Harbor. And for us to now trust Japan to be totally independent and able to enact military engagements wherever they feel like it, which is what we've seen them gradually being able to do over the course of many decades now, it just shows that we have forgotten a lot of that history. The same thing happened with Germany, where we rebuilt them through the Marshall Plan. These are nations that have been extremely dangerous enemies of the West whenever they have had the power to be so. We can't just forget about that and trust them to go out on their own.
Yeah, they say today Japan boasts one of the top 10 military arsenals in the world and the 4th largest navy, which is really interesting because I don't think I would naturally think of them in that way. They're not a large country. But still very powerful, the great technology, of course. Despite all its industrial, economic, and naval strength, Japan has been, quite recently, seen as a benign power, constrained by memories of the nuclear disaster that ended its past imperial exploits. But, as has been the case with so many other nations, the events of September 11, 2001, altered the Japanese mentality. It's really amazing if you think about 9/11. It didn't just change the U.S., it changed the whole world. That one attack, it made everybody, you know, start to think about war and protecting themselves and global alliances. And it really, when we look back, even, you know, as time goes on, that is such a huge event, that 9/11, because it changed the whole world.
Yeah, if America could take a hit like that, what must these other nations be thinking when they probably don't have the same security agencies and forces in play like America does. And for Japan to then just sit back after seeing something like that and continue to pledge to be passive, to continue to only use its military, maybe just to defend itself from imminent attack, but for nothing else outside of its borders, Japan must be in a near panic to try to conceive of an idea like that. It's almost insanity at this point for any nation to just be that naive, to trust other nations for their defense, to basically put their safety and security needs in the hands of another nation, because you see how brutal the world can be sometimes, and how at any moment there could be just a devastating strike.
Right, and that's probably what sets everybody on edge, is that it literally was an out of the blue attack in a lot of ways. And so, you know, it's not like you have to, normally I suppose you'd see another rising power and think, okay, we might need to prepare for some sort of war there. With terrorism, it's a constant war. You just don't know when it's going to show up. And so, like this book points out, events stemming from September 11th, 2001 brought about what the New York Times called the most significant transformation in Japan's military since World War II. Japan's military is looking less and less like a self-defense force. In 2004, Japan sent non-combat troops to Iraq. I'm always a bit perplexed by the non-combat troops. Are you going to watch the war unfold? Like, I know they're there to, like, you know, help out with other aspects of it, but that's always an interesting term to me.
It is confusing because they're still called troops, which you automatically associate with war, with combat, and yet they're just going over there to be, you know, like the UN calls it, peacekeeping forces. Well, on the one hand, they keep the peace, but they're also a force. So, you know, it's just kind of paradoxical there.
Yeah, and if they got attacked, they'd have to fight back, so they'd have to be ready to go. But anyway, that's an aside. They sent the non-combat troops to Iraq. At the end of 2006, Japan's defense agency was upgraded to become a full-fledged ministry, giving it a louder and clearer voice in Japan's cabinet. In 2007, Japan's F-2s flew 1,700 miles without refueling and dropped 500-pound live bombs as part of a training exercise. One of those, you know, hey, look what we can do, just in case you're interested. Now Japan is even looking to use space for military purposes. And so they are really, really gaining in that military strength. And then also, of course, they point out in April 2014, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe removed the weapons export ban that had been enacted in 1967. So they were able to get involved in some of those weapons transactions. And a few months later, Tokyo made the decision to reinterpret a key section of its pacifist constitution, the ban on collective self-defense. And, you know, so it's a small step from self-defense to offensive attacks. You know, that's the first step, right? You know, well, we want to be able to defend ourselves, which means you could also attack somebody.
And it doesn't take too much sometimes to amend a constitution. It's not a fundamental change of the entire document, but just to amend it and say, well, at one time it was only for self-defense. Now we can defend our allies. Now we can actually send troops outside our borders, which we couldn't do before. Like, gradually, just very slowly, without hardly anyone noticing, they've been totally changing the purpose of their gigantic military.
Yeah, and if you look, you know, historically at nations that geared up for war, I think of Germany in World War II, they changed key aspects of their laws in their land to allow certain things. They don't do it all at once. You know, they don't come out one day and say, by the way, we're building a war machine. they do it piece by piece just like this, and probably have good logical reasons for doing it or bring those up. But before you know it, you've got a full-fledged military force.
And any shrewd leader of a nation would use any sort of world event in his favor. So, for example, some nations may think that they are totally equipped to prevent terrorist attacks already, but 9/11, that was an excuse for some of those confident leaders to even take more measures in terms of self-defense, or even more proactive measures to improve their national strength. And so anytime there's a terrorist attack, or anytime there's aggression off their coast or something like that, they can use those events as a means to justify extreme military buildup sometimes.
Yeah, I remember just even right after 9/11, in the couple months and years afterwards, they were, you'd see a lot of news footage of nations holding anti-terrorism drills, and they were, you know, fully equipped to withstand, say, a chemical warfare attack, the bio suits on and the guns and all this. And you'd see that in a lot of nations, and nations that you weren't probably used to seeing military activity. But, we got to prepare for terrorism. So it is interesting how 9/11 did reshape things. It would be a fascinating book. I don't know if there are any out there on that topic, but, boy, that would be an interesting book. Not just to see how it impacted, say, the U.S. and, like, Iraq and that, but, like, the whole world. Maybe there's some out there already, but that'd be a great read.
Yeah, it really would. And sometimes, you know, maybe full-on military drills are a bit too much, because the whole point of terrorism is that you're not fighting a tangible army. The terrorists are blended in with the population. You can't necessarily just launch missiles indiscriminately and hope to only hit terrorists and no civilian victims. But, you know, you could use that as a reason to march your military out there, show the world how powerful you are, maybe even form some strong alliances with other nations and go from there. It actually becomes something much more than just responding to a terrorist attack.
Yeah, and I think Russia, Vladimir Putin, he's used terrorism to his advantage. There's even a lot of thought that he was behind some of it on his own people, just to to have an enemy to go after and kind of galvanize his base. So I don't know. There's debate about that, but there's pretty good evidence that may have happened.
Yeah, Saul Alinsky said never to let a crisis go to waste. So that's something that a lot of smart leaders do. They maybe feel sad for a moment about some tragedy that takes place, but at the same time, they're using it to their geopolitical advantage.
Right. Yeah. The another thing that's really interesting here that this chapter brings out about Japan is that Shinzo Abe, there's a chance here that he's returning Japan to something they say as arcane and archaic as emperor worship. Would he do something like that? They say a clue to the answer came in October 2013, when he became the first Japanese prime minister since World War II to participate in a ceremony at the Ice Shrine, if I'm saying that right, I-S-E, the holiest of Japan's Shinto institutions. The ceremony entailed rebuilding the shrine and bringing idols to it that represent the emperor's divine ancestry. And so that's going back in that direction more. And why that's important is because they're trying to get back to Japan's lost values, as they put it. And those people really, really did worship the emperors. Matter of fact, if you read some of the history of World War II, the people that survived the bombings there in Hiroshima, they talk about, in recounting the memory of that day, they talk about how amazing it was, how awestruck they were to hear the voice of the emperor. They never heard his voice. And he said something to the people at that time. And so here were these people that had just been radiated and were in terrible condition, and yet they all stopped and started crying because they heard the voice of the emperor. And others that survived said they didn't hold a grudge against the U.S. for what they did, because they would have never stopped fighting unless the emperor told them. So that's the kind of worship that they had for that leader.
Well, you can understand how powerful an influence like that would be. Any person of any religion, if they think they literally have their God descended and in their midst, and he is issuing commands, and you can literally see him and hear him right in front of you like that, people are going to do anything to please their God, their master, in that way. And that's what sort of contributed to the Japanese unstoppable mindset in World War II and throughout their history. Whenever they've had that Shinto religious influence, they believe that their emperor is God, and they will do anything to please him. They will conduct suicide missions, you know, kamikaze fighter pilots, things like that. They will even kill themselves if they don't complete their military mission. Just totally extreme things that most of us could never imagine doing. But if we had God in our midst, supposedly, and he was right in front of us talking to us, maybe a lot of us would go pretty far.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing, even if you look at the Islamic terrorism. I mean, that's why they're so tough to deal with in some ways, at least the way we try to deal with it, because they don't have regard for their own life. And so what do you, you know, talking doesn't do anything. They're not afraid of that because they're already committed to giving their life to their cause. And so we saw that with Japan in World War II, and they're starting to go back towards that emperor worship. So something to keep your eye on. Also, it says that the Chinese dragon has long been, it might seem, slumberously watching as U.S. global dominance wanes, but it seeks to build a global power block in the East to replace it. To create such a block, China needs more than just Russia. The book's called Russia and China in Prophecy, but there are other nations involved here. Yeah, those are the two main ones, of course. But they do need other ones to change the regional balance in Eurasia, and they cannot affect the global balance with just the two of them. So they need Japan, they need India, some of these other nations, and they're jumping on the bandwagon. They're all looking east again and giving up on their Western allies.
It is a lot easier to just, even just geographically, to have your allies as your physical neighbors instead of someone who is way across the Pacific Ocean, many thousands of miles away from you. Sure, America does have military bases elsewhere, but the bulk of American power, you would think, would be on the mainland and not overseas. So even from that standpoint, it makes sense that Japan would make a turn toward Asia. But also, you know, they have much more in common culturally with each other. Their religions are much more similar. Their belief systems would, in a way, bind them. Of course, they've also suffered some brutal wars against each other. But sometimes when you have these similar lifestyles, they have a similar value placed on the family, those things can even override difficult pasts.
It's a change in the way the nations are aligning. That's we can see that happening. They say in this book, Russia and China in Prophecy, the prospect of the continued expansion of the EU into a combined bloc larger and more powerful than the U.S. and Russia, and the perceived weakening of U.S. global influence is driving China and its Asian neighbors to position themselves as the next great global power bloc. Russia, China, and Japan will likely combine in Asian alliances, with the ultimate intention of forcing the U.S. out of the Russian sphere of influence and out of the Western Pacific. Then, as has been the strategy of the EU, Asian political and economic cooperation will ultimately progress to a military and security alliance. If you just check your headlines every day and you hear about it on The Trumpet Daily and at thetrumpet.com, you see that these two power blocks rising, this European power block, this Asian power block, and then, as we mentioned yesterday, the U.S. just getting more and more weak and bickering about national anthems and so forth. And these other blocks are coming together and becoming a very formidable force on the world scene.
Yeah, and that quote in this booklet just illuminates how some of these nations, what they're pretty much all they're doing is looking around at other parts of the world, and they're seeing who's powerful, who's weak. The Asians, you can be sure, have noticed the European continent. They've been hit by all these crises, but they know that Europe is going to unite over that, and they understand the threat that a united Europe could pose against them. They also see America on the decline. Europe also notices Asia's resurgence. It just seems like the only group of people totally naive to all this, like you mentioned, is us, because we're too divided, we're bickering too much. In a lot of cases, we might just see some of these other areas as our little brothers, because for so long, America has been dominant on the world stage, and we don't necessarily think of the threats that these power blocks could pose. Sure, individually, no nation stands up to America. But they're not trying to do it individually. They're building these massive power blocks that America is not going to know how to handle.
Yeah, that's a really good point. They, if you look at them individually, you'd think, well, you know, they're not that strong. But you put them all together, it's like an adult, you know, looking at a child. You think, wow, it's just one kid, and then you get 100 of them,
and they come after you.
That's a pretty powerful group.
It's actually quite a bit more formidable. And like this booklet also mentions, they see the rise of Islam, whether it's in national form or radical Islam in terrorism form, and they're threatened by that as well. So America can't even agree that radical Islam is an enemy, and we try to, America and Britain as well, we try to invite them in our borders and coexist with them. The nation of Israel does the same thing. Other it seems like these other powers in Europe and Asia have a much better grasp on reality, and they know exactly what's happening on the world scene, and they know what they have to do to become the top power.
Yeah, they're preparing for the future. It says here, an article in the April 1968 Plain Truth, so quite a while ago, said, despite its many national, religious, and political differences, Asia will ultimately be welded together into a common power block. It will ultimately send its military muscle into the Middle East at the return of Jesus Christ. This prophecy is recorded in Revelation 16, verse 12 and 16. Japan will play a vital role in this battle. And so that's talked about more in the next chapter. We don't have time to get into that, but you can look at that in this book, Russia and China and Prophecy, at the trumpet.com. Some of the things they say to watch for is East Asian alliances to develop economically and militarily. Watch for coming agreements between Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, and others to harness the maverick North Korea. They're always doing something. And muscle the U.S. out of the Oriental diplomacy in Korea and Taiwan. That's, I think, happening already. Watch for a third great power bloc to emerge in the East to balance the power of the expanding European Union and the volatile Islamic tide. Those are things to keep an eye on, and of course they keep looking at those at the trumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the Key of David program, and also the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program, and Watch Jerusalem, all coming up this weekend. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.